Thank you, Jeff. It's nice to be with you again this morning. It's only a couple of weeks, isn't it, since I was last here, but this time I'm speaking, so hopefully you can find some useful exhortation to help prepare us for our sharing bread and wine this morning. Just get me this open. So we'll see. Well, when I am weak, then I am strong. Famous words, aren't they, from our brother Paul. How do these famous words out of Paul, how do they make you feel? Do they make you feel hopeful, reassured, relieved, perhaps? Maybe you feel weak in some way. Maybe in many ways you feel weak. And so this message of Paul, there is strength in weakness. Maybe that gives you confidence that despite your problems, your troubles, whatever they might be, that some good will come of it. God is working with you and through you in some way. There is a point to it all. Perhaps, however, it fills you with concern, even a bit of dread. For is this not saying that for God to work powerfully with us and in our lives, that you will be brought low? You must be brought low into a position of weakness in some way. It is saying, well, it seems to be saying that the weakness or the trouble or the suffering that you are going through is necessary. And there's no reason to think that it will pass anytime soon. It might never pass. At least not in our mortal lives. Or perhaps you might compare your current situation with the situations of other people, and you might think that, well, relatively speaking at least, you aren't so weak. Perhaps things are not so bad at the moment. Maybe you're in a reasonably comfortable position. Maybe things are okay in your life at the moment. And this message of Paul seems to be saying that, well, you know, either God isn't really working with you much at the moment, or maybe you shouldn't get so comfortable, because it won't be long before he shakes things up and brings you once again into a position of weakness. And who wants that, really? Who wants to feel weak? Who wants to be helpless? Who wants to feel powerless? Who wants to feel that things are out of their control? I don't feel that way. That's not something I want. And I suspect it's not something that you want either. You'd rather not be in a position of weakness, would you? So is Paul saying then that the only way for God to work with us and through us is for us to go through significant and extended periods of weakness and suffering and trouble and difficulty? And if that's what it takes to have a relationship with God, is that something I really want? So for me, at least, maybe for you as well, this idea of strength in weakness, although I get some reassurance from it, if I'm honest, it also scares me a little bit. Actually, it scares me quite a lot. You know, maybe if I was someone who was scrabbling around in poverty, struggling with persecution, suffering from terrible health, well, maybe I'd see this statement of Paul shining through like a beacon of hope in a dark sky. But at least for me at the moment, those are not my circumstances. And so it's with some trepidation that I read these words of Paul about strength in weakness. But am I right to feel that way? Or am I understanding things wrong? So for exhortation, what I'd like to do is to wrestle a little bit with this idea of strength in weakness. I use that word wrestle deliberately, as we'll see a little bit later on. Well, the first question, obvious question for me anyway, is to ask, well, when Paul is talking about weakness and being strong and weakness, what does he mean? What does he mean by weak? What does he mean by strong? Is it physical weakness that he's talking about here and strength? Is it mental weakness and strength? Maybe it's economic weakness or political weakness or spiritual weakness. What's he talking about? Maybe it's a bit of all of these things that he has in mind when he's saying this. Well, God's been trying to teach people about strength and weakness, the wisdom. He's been trying to teach people wisdom about these things all the way from the beginning. And so there's many places that we could go to in the Bible to help us with this topic. But there's really just two characters I want to think about for a few moments for exhortation. First, obviously, is Paul. Now, Paul picks up on this idea of strength and weakness in a few places. I just want to kind of turn there, and they're in Corinthians, 1 Corinthians and 2 Corinthians. First of all, we've got 2 Corinthians chapter 11 and 12. And Paul, the summary of this really, is that Paul equates weakness with quite a few different things, with his physical limitations, but also with hardships, persecutions, imprisonment, betrayal, and so on. So, first of all, 2 Corinthians chapter 11. He's recalling things which have happened to him as he's been going around his preaching work. So, from verse 24, he says, 5 times I received at the hands of the Jews 40 lashes, less one. 3 times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. 3 times I was shipwrecked. At night and the day I was adrift at the sea. On frequent journeys, in danger from rivers, in danger from robbers, in danger from my own people, in danger from Gentiles, in danger in the city, in danger in the wilderness, in danger at sea, in danger from false brothers, in toil and hardship, through many a sleepless night, in hunger and thirst, often without food, in cold and exposure. And apart from all these things, the daily anxieties and pressures of caring about the church. Who is weak, he says, and I am not weak. Who is made to fall, and I am not indignant. If I must boast, then I will boast of the things that show my weakness. In the next chapter, chapter 12, he carries on, says, in a similar theme, verse 5. On my own behalf, I will not boast except of my weakness. Though if I should wish to boast, and I would not be a fool, for I would be speaking the truth, but I refrain from it so that no one may think more of me than he sees in me or hears from me. So, and then he talks about the thorn in his flesh that God gave to him, and how he pleaded to be delivered from this. But in verse 9, God says to Paul, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly of my weakness, so that the power of God may rest upon me. So, and then, yes, for when I am weak, in verse 10, then I am strong. So Paul is not limiting himself, is he? With what he's including as weakness. It's a long list. But I suggest that the underlying connection between these different types of weaknesses that he talks about here is a lack of control. Paul is very obviously not at all in control of his circumstances. But yet he's found that when he feels the least in control, it is on these occasions that God seems to work most powerfully with it. So is that the key then? For God to work with us, we need to be reduced to a position of powerlessness. We need to be placed into circumstances that are out of our control and where we feel completely helpless and weak. Well, when Paul talks about weakness, he does so, as we've seen, in connection with boasting. And actually, this reflection that he has on weakness and strength and boasting actually starts slightly earlier in chapter 10. So I'll come back a couple of chapters to chapter 10. He starts talking about boasting there in verse 15. We do not boast beyond limit in the labours of others. And he carries on there. And then in verse 17, he says, let the one who boasts, boasts in the Lord. For it is not the one who commends himself who is approved, but the one whom the Lord commends. And then he talks about, as we've seen, about boasting in his weakness. Actually, this isn't the first time he's talked about boasting either. This is where we go back to 1 Corinthians. So he's already picked up on this theme in his first letter. So come back into 1 Corinthians now, chapter 1. And it turns out that this theme is quite central to his whole message of 1 Corinthians. Verse 26, 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 26. Consider your calling, brothers, he says there. Not many of you were wise according to worldly standards. Not many were powerful. Not many of you were of noble birth. But God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. He chose what is weak to shame the strong. He chose what is low and despised to bring to nothing those that are, so that no human being might boast in the presence of God. And because of him, you are in Christ Jesus, who became to us wisdom from God, righteousness and sanctification and redemption, so that it is written, let the one who boasts, boast in the Lord. So he's putting things together here, Paul, isn't he? This weakness in the Lord, in combination with wisdom, true wisdom, not worldly wisdom, the true wisdom that comes from God, that frames his entire message in Corinthians. In the next chapter, chapter 2, he contrasts the wisdom of the world with the wisdom of God. He says there, chapter 2, verse 2, I decided to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. I was with you in weakness and in fear and much trembling. So that, verse 5, your faith might not rest in the wisdom of men, but in the power of God. And then he continues in chapter 4. Chapter 4, verse 9. I think that God has exhibited us apostles last of all, like men sentenced to death, because we have become a spectacle to the world. We are fools for Christ's sake, but you are wise in Christ. We are weak, but you are strong. You are held in honour, but we in disrepute. So at the core of this message in Corinthians then are his warnings about them boasting, his warnings about them being puffed up, about being more concerned with exercising their rights than displaying humility and submission to God and to each other and building each other up. So from our initial observations then, that there's something important about being placed in a position of powerlessness and a position of weakness, about not being in control of our circumstances, we can add to it that our attitude, what we've seen here in 1 Corinthians, that our attitude and our way of thinking about these things is also important. And this is something that he calls wisdom. These all have a part to play in what Paul and what God is teaching us about strength and weakness. So, at the front, the sort of the root then of this idea is this idea of let those who boast, boast in the Lord. And this is where we kind of go on to our second character. So we've had a look there briefly about what Paul's got to say. But he's basing his thoughts on some thoughts from the Old Testament, and that is the prophet Jeremiah. So I'm going to turn to Jeremiah then for a few minutes as well to get some thoughts from there. It's a quote from Jeremiah chapter 9, verse 24. Now, I've been talking a little bit about control, and this idea of control is also at the root of Jeremiah's prophecy. He's very much talking about God is in control, making clear that God is in control, and human beings, in particular Israel, Israel's leadership, Israel's kings, they are absolutely not in control. Jeremiah himself is absolutely not in control of his circumstances. And Jeremiah is trying to teach the people of Israel and Judah that the only way that human beings can be truly successful, that Israel can be successful, that Israel's leaders and kings can be successful, is to accept this fact that they are not in control of their circumstances and that God is in control. They need to stop fighting against God's will to let God do what he has said. Don't resist it, but embrace it. Israel have been taught from the very start, haven't they, of their existence. It is in the acceptance of their weakness and their lack of control and their submission to God that is where their strength comes from. Jacob was taught it, wasn't he? Joseph was taught it through his trials in Egypt. Moses was taught it, and so on. And indeed, when we think about that summary, famous summary in the Old Testament, of the Old Testament, in Hebrews chapter 11, the writer there says, doesn't he, that the time would fail me to tell of those who, amongst other things, were made strong out of weakness. But yet Israel did not want to accept this, did they? Strength in weakness, in powerlessness, was foolishness in their eyes. That's not wisdom. Wisdom for them, worldly wisdom, was that you find strength in strength. And so they resisted God's will for them. They wrestled against God, just as Jacob wrestled against the angel of God. Indeed, one view is that the very name Israel means he who wrestles with God. And what's he wrestling? Well, he's wrestling with God for control. It's a name that sums up very well the relationship between Israel and God in the Old Testament. Very close and personal, right into the faces, we might say, but it's a struggle. It's a wrestle for control. Israel wanted to bend God to their will rather than submit to his control and his will. And that is really the story of the Old Testament and Israel's relationship with God. And so Jeremiah, he picks up this theme that Israel must learn, finally, that God really is the one in control, which means that they need to be shown very clearly that he is the strong one and they are the weak ones. Only then, when they've acknowledged their weakness before God, when they've accepted it, when they've embraced it, only then can they become strong, because it's only then that they will truly be listening to the wisdom of God. Only when they stop resisting do they embrace what God is showing them and teaching them about strength and weakness. And, you know, we have some wonderful passages in Jeremiah, well-known passages that pick up on this theme. And we're just going to quickly go through one or two of them now. You can turn these up if you want, but I'm just going to read them. Firstly, in Jeremiah chapter 1 and verse 4, you know, where we read right from the very start, God has been controlling Jeremiah's life from the womb. The word of the Lord came to me saying, "Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I consecrated you. I appointed you a prophet to the nations." So God's always been in control, even from Jeremiah being in the womb. Chapter 10, verse 23. I know, O Lord, that the way of man is not in himself. It is not in man who walks to direct his steps. Or the Jeremiah 18, first few verses there, where Jeremiah picks on the potter, the idea, the image of the potter and the clay. The word that came to Jeremiah from the Lord, arise and go down to the potter's house, and there I will let you hear my words. I went down to the potter's house, and he was working at his wheel. And the vessel he was making of clay was spoiled in the potter's hand, and he reworked it into another vessel, as it seemed good to the potter to do. The word of the Lord came to me, O house of Israel, can I not do with you as this potter has done, declares the Lord. Behold, like the clay in the potter's hand, so are you in my hand, O house of Israel. Chapter 20 of Jeremiah. Jeremiah sort of wrestling, if you like, expressing what it feels like to have God directing him. Says in verse 7, O Lord, you have deceived me, and I was deceived. You are stronger than I, and you have prevailed. Verse 8, for whenever I speak and cry out, I shout violence and destruction. For the word of the Lord has become for me a reproach and a derision all day long. If I say I will not mention him, I will not any more speak in his name, there is in my heart, as it were, a burning fire shut up in my bones, and I am weary with holding it in. I cannot hold it in. And, you know, we could go on. Talks many times later on. The last one we'll have a look at is in Jeremiah chapter 36. And this is Jeremiah in conversation with Jehoiakim, one of the kings at that time in Jerusalem. A weak king in a weak situation, but who was wrestling with God's will. Jeremiah chapter 36. Jeremiah has a message for Jehoiakim about how he must submit to God's will and to the Babylonians. Verse 21. The king sent Jehudi to get the scroll of Jeremiah, and he took it from the chamber, and he read it to the king and all the officials who were with the king. Verse 23. As Jehudi read three or four columns, the king would cut them off with a knife and throw them into the fire in the fire pot until the entire scroll was consumed in the fire that was in the fire pot. Verse 25. Even when Elnathan and Deliah and Gemariah urged the king not to burn the scroll, he would not listen to them. So there's no more clear way, is there, of refusing, resisting God's will, than by taking his message and burning it in the fire. A weak king in a weak set of circumstances, where does he seek his strength? Not in the Lord, but in the political alliances with strong powers. He was trying to negotiate with Egypt and others. But there's no strength in this weakness, because there is no acceptance of God's will, is there? No acknowledgement of God's sovereignty, but instead fighting it, resisting it, wrestling with God for control, rather than letting things go and letting God do what he has said. And so we come to chapters 8 and 9 then, where we're going to finish. Jeremiah chapter 8, first of all verse 5. Why has this people turned away in perpetual backsliding? They hold fast to deceit. They refuse to return. What we've said, continually turning away from God, resisting him, wrestling with him for control. Verse 6. I've been listening to what they have been saying, says God, but they have not spoken rightly. They do not relent of their evil. Everyone turns to his own course, like a horse plunging headlong into battle. charging about without thinking, without wisdom, not interested in doing God's will or even trying to find out what it is. Verse 7, he then uses an image of birds migrating. Even the stork in the heavens knows her time, and the turtle dove, the swallow, the crane. They keep the time of their coming, but my people, they do not know the rules of the Lord. And then verse 8, how can you say we are wise? And that was what Paul was talking about, wasn't he? Wisdom, true wisdom. How can you say we are wise, but behold, the lying pen of the scribes has made it into a lie? Verse 9, the wise men shall be put to shame. They shall be dismayed and taken. They have rejected the word of the Lord. So what wisdom is in them? You know, wisdom is not something to be shut away in a book, is it? But it's living and active. Though they have the law, the wise, or the so-called wise of Israel, in reality they rejected the word of the Lord, didn't they? So really, what wisdom did they have? You know, and I think there's a clear warning for us in this. You know, granted we're not a nation with a law, but, you know, we proclaim ourselves, don't we, to be part of God's ecclesia. You know, we talk about how we have the truth. But do we talk about the truth in the same way that these wise men of Israel talked about the law? You know, whilst in practice, rejecting the word and the wisdom of the Lord. Chapter 9, verse 12. Who is the man so wise that he can understand this? Where is the wisdom in the suffering and judgment of Israel, is the question. To whom has the mouth of the Lord spoken that he may declare it? Why is the land ruined and laid waste? Who can understand this wisdom? What's going on here? Verse 13 and 14 will tell us, well, this is happening, this weakness, this powerlessness, has happened because they have forsaken my law that I have set before them. They have not obeyed my voice or walked in accord with it, but they have stubbornly followed their own hearts and have gone after the Baals as their father taught them. That's why this is happening. It's because they have not obeyed God's voice, but are following their own will, following their own hearts. You know, and again, is that describing us? Do we have the word of the Lord in front of us and the wisdom of the Lord readily available, but nevertheless follow our own paths, follow our own course, rather than submitting to the will of our Father? And then finally, we come back to this boasting, and boasting in weakness, and boasting in the Lord. In chapter 9, verse 23 and 24. And this is where Paul quotes from. Thus says the Lord, let not the wise man boast in his wisdom, let not the mighty man boast in his might, let not the rich man boast in his riches, but let him who boasts boast in this, that he understands and knows me, that I am the Lord who practices steadfast love, justice, and righteousness in the earth. For in these things I delight, declares the Lord. Now Paul, he quotes the first bit, doesn't he? But Jeremiah goes further when he says, I am the Lord who practices steadfast love and justice and righteousness in the earth. So when Paul talks to us then of strength and weakness and boasting in weakness, I don't think what he's saying is that the life of a Christian must be one of suffering and persecution. He's not saying that it must be full of poverty and destitution, that we must have physical and mental weakness and ill health. It may well involve those things. That may be how God decides to try and teach us. It may involve some of these things. It may involve many of these things. I don't think, though, that Paul is teaching us anything here about the quantum the amount of suffering that a Christian may be required to endure in their lifetime. In fact, as we saw from King Jehoiakim, there's nothing inevitable in strength emerging from weakness. What I think Paul is doing there when he talks to us of strength and weakness is he's talking about the wisdom that comes from an acknowledgement that we are not in control, but that God is in control. And as I said, there's a myriad number of ways that God may try and teach us this truth. Ways that God might try and bend us to his will. We never have been and never will be in control. And we should stop trying to wrestle God for control. Easier said than done. We should accept our weakness in front of him. Acknowledge his power and his sovereignty. We should let go, if you like, and let God. For when we do this, as I think Jeremiah is saying here in verse 24, when we accept our weakness in front of God, when we stop resisting and actually start listening to what it is that he's teaching us, then we begin to understand just a little bit and truly know who God is, his character. And as we come to know God, well, you know, then we begin to become moulded by him, like the potter moulding the clay. We start to become a vessel for his steadfast love, his justice and his righteousness. We start to become a vessel for the character of God. And then, of course, it's the character of God, isn't it, ultimately, in which we find all wisdom and power and strength and glory. Just a few words from 1 Corinthians chapter 1 to finish with. Where is the one who is wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through wisdom, it pleased God through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe. For Jews demand signs, Greeks seek wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews, folly to Gentiles. But to those who are called, both Jew and Greek, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men.